is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. This is the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We appreciate everybody taking time today to join us for another edition of Midrats. And for those that are with the esteemed cohort that is joining us live, if you are so inclined, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That is where you will find the chat room. Roll in there with the usual suspects, and if you have some observations you would like to share during the course of the show, or if there are questions you would like for us to direct to our guest, that's a great place to put it, because we'll both be keeping an eye on it as the show progresses. And as a friendly reminder, as always, if you've got to run off and take care of some business, and you want to catch up on what you missed for the part of the show that you walked away from, or if there are previous episodes you'd like to catch up on, remember, just go over to iTunes, Spreaker, whichever podcast aggregator you get, the podcast will be waiting there for you, and you can pick it up and listen at your convenience. And scrolling on to today's show, fewer carriers are deploying more and more, and a lot has been written about that recently because depending upon how you want to measure it, there is a lot of warning lights that this very expensive and very rare asset is having some trouble from overuse and overlove, and not just the ships themselves, but there's an entire ecosystem from personnel to maintenance that are showing signs that all is not what it should be. What we're going to do today is we're going to talk about this critical topic, how we got here, where we are today, and what we can expect in the near future. And we're going to use her article from one of our two guests today as kind of a starting point for our conversation. You can find a link to it over at the show page. No margin left, overworked carrier force struggles to maintain deployments after decades of overuse. The title kind of speaks for itself. And our first guest today, and they're actually going to both of us here at the same time, they come to us from USI News, Deputy Editor Megan Eckstein, and Sam Lagrone, who is a repeat customer here at Midrats, as Editor of USNI News. And they are both with us this afternoon. Megan and Sam, welcome to Midrats.
Hi, thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
And just kind of a scene setter to get things kicked off, as I kind of touched on in the intro, the debate about carriers, their use and their maintenance and their challenges and even their utility, it's a decades-old topic, and in the last year, there has been a lot of writing and reporting on it. And I guess I'll direct the first question over to Megan, and then, Sam, you can roll in when need be. But over at USNI News, Megan, y'all decided to do more than just a 500-page summary or a breaking news announcement, and I would really recommend the listeners take time to grab the article and get a cup of coffee, because y'all put in a lot of work. There's a lot of interviews. There's a lot of detail. There are some good numbers there to look at the problem in a little more depth than your usual soundbite is. What brought you to the point, Megan, that you and Sam decided now is the time that we need to bring this out and use this format?
Yeah, well, thank you for drawing attention to the story. It really has been a labor of love, and it's been a little bit of a headache over the past about 10 months is how long we've been working on it. So last year, Sam and I had just been discussing something just seemed off on the East Coast carrier fleet, couldn't quite put our fingers on what it was. And when Truman had their electrical malfunction kind of right before going on deployment last year, it began to spark the aha moment. I think, you know, I had been posing questions to the Navy about the fragility of the force and the fragility of the readiness they were creating, and kind of it seemed, you know, they were one catastrophe away from not being able to meet their deployments. I kept being told, no, 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 that's not the case. And of course, you know, thankfully Truman was able to get repaired and back out on deployment after not too exhaustive of an effort, which was good. But I think that was sort of a warning that we were on the right track, that there may be a carrier readiness issue. But, you know, earlier this year in January, I saw a PowerPoint slide that kind of went through the status of each aircraft carrier in the Navy's fleet. And that was really the light bulb moment. You know, I don't want to overemphasize the East Coast, West Coast thing, but, you know, on the West Coast, you kind of had one carrier on deployment. You had one that was working up. You had one that had just gotten out of maintenance, one that was just going into maintenance, and kind of, you know, all was as it should be under the optimized fleet response plan. And then you looked at the East Coast, and it was, you know, you had USS Dwight D. Eisenhower, and you had Truman, and kind of, you know, they seemed to be bouncing back and forth between one being overworked and one being in maintenance, but that was it. You know, Ford's not ready. Ford's not completed, you know, post-delivery tests and trials, still needs to go through shock trials. It'll be a while until she can start to take over some of that burden. And George H.W. Bush is in the midst of a 28-month maintenance cycle. And obviously all that work needs to happen, but it just really kind of was this aha moment. Like, you have one coast really putting optimized fleet response plan to use, and the other one is just, you know, you're either underworked or you're overworked, but nobody's really, you know, keeping with what the model should be. So that kicked off the reporting effort, really. I think, you know, a lot of people in the Navy were a little hesitant to talk about aircraft carrier readiness, but I'm glad we were able to get the deployment data and the maintenance data to really make that point that, you know, there are fewer carriers ready to take on missions right now than an average year. And there's also a lot more missions being asked of them. I don't think the story was meant to be, you know, overly critical of any one crew or, you know, even the Navy overall, but really just to say that a lot is being asked of the carrier force at a time when they don't necessarily have as much to give.
Oh, is it my turn to ask a question? I was reading the article, and my thought was you could have titled it Robbing Peter to Pay Paul or Rode Hard and Hung Up Wet, and it would have applied. But it goes much deeper than things like that, because this ties back into the infrastructure of our shipyards and the conditions of the public shipyards where a lot of the work is done on these things. Can you kind of discuss how that plays into carrier preparedness, Sam, or?
Sure, I'll take a crack at that. So I think what the numbers that at USNI that we assembled is essentially like this, just to be clear, kind of follow up on Megan's point, is this is in a database that the Navy maintains. As far as we can tell, the Navy doesn't think about the way they deploy their carriers, or at least illustrated on the outside, the way that we tried to assemble it all for a holistic look. So we took every single deployment back to 1964 and put it in a spreadsheet. And that took us a little bit, but that's something that we kind of like tend to maintain. And from there, we can look at deployment trends in terms of like where people are going, how long they've been out. And then we can compare that to the size of the fleet. And what we were seeing and what Megan found and started to pick out was that as you were starting to see more and more strain in the system, a lot of that was centered on the East Coast and on the maintenance that they were able to do. And if you were to go and check out her story, Surflint, who didn't get to us on the record, but told Tailhook that his thing that keeps him up at night is in particular aircraft carrier maintenance on the East Coast. So there are a lot of questions swirling around the efficacy of the Norfolk neighbor shipyard and whether or not they're able to maintain the carriers at the same rate as their folks out of Puget Sound over at Bremerton. So they're really starting to be a lot of attention and a lot of focus on how fast you can turn around carriers over on the East Coast, and that seems to be a one of the big driving factors of what's taking a lot of the margin out of the system, because these maintenance availabilities keep going longer and longer and longer.
Yeah, and if I could just follow on to that, one thing that came out of the reporting, the shipyards are in an interesting time right now. For the past, many years, they have had significant submarine work, in the sense that the SSBNs had to be refueled at these public yards, which is a big undertaking. That work is just wrapping up now, as well as in Norfolk, they were doing more training ship conversions, which was also another big effort on top of their usual workload. So on the one hand, things should be getting better going forward now that those two efforts are done. However, there have been a lot of concerns. For example, Eisenhower's previous maintenance period, there was a lot of rework that had to be done, which contributed, I think it was scheduled for 6 months, ended up lasting 18 or 19 months. Part of it was simply just not enough workers at the yard being available to focus on Eisenhower. Part of it was, the amount of rework that had to be done. So there's various contributing factors. Some of them are about to be, alleviated as the submarine work goes away. But some of it, in terms of the rework, a lot of that is workforce training and just the newness of a lot of the employees. And that's still a concern going forward. So, again, it's not to point fingers at anybody and say it's their fault, but there's a lot of contributing factors for aircraft carrier readiness at the moment.
And Megan, just to kind of pull the thread on that is when I was going through the article a second time, where the things I'd highlighted when I wrote it the first time, something popped up that I kind of felt guilty that I hadn't really thought of before. And one is kind of a statement to the obvious. It wasn't too long ago in living memory that we had a mix of conventional and nuclear carriers. And as we retired all of our conventional carriers, I think the Kennedy was the last, or was the Connie the last? I forgot who was the last. All of our carriers are now nuclear. And, of course, all of our submarines are nuclear. And we are still suffering a little bit under the cloud of all the BRAC shutdowns from the 1990s. So it's part of the problem that we have here is we have a higher percentage of our capital ships are nuclear, with a limited number of nuclear-capable shipyards, point one. And point two, as you dove into some of the maintenance shortfalls that we're having, and you focused rightly on the East Coast, but there are also some on the West Coast. Did it creep into your mind some of the reporting that you've done about us talking about growing the Navy significantly? We have this challenge with the fleet we have right now. How do we service 10-15% or larger higher? And were there any discussions about capacity of shipyards and service?
Yeah, I didn't get as much into that topic in the story as I would have liked to. I was told that 7,000 words was a lot to take in at one time. But in other recent reporting on Battle Force 2045, that's definitely something we've looked at. The size of the nuclear-powered aircraft carrier fleet is not likely to go up. In fact, it's more likely to go down. However, the size of the nuclear-powered submarine force is going to go up, and they're all maintained, as you said, at the same four public shipyards. Just the difficult thing about this is that, in addition to the four public yards, there's only two other locations that are allowed to work on nuclear-powered ships, which is Newport News Shipbuilding in Virginia and Electric Boat up in Connecticut. They're both being asked to build more submarines as part of this growth. So there's a lot of conversation happening right now about what their role in maintenance should be. I think the Navy is kind of in the position right now where they want to see more construction and more maintenance activities happening at both those locations. But honestly, I've been to both recently, or pre-COVID recently, and they're both kind of maxed out on space. So at this point, I think there's some serious talks happening in terms of what it would take for them to contribute more to submarine maintenance, which, if successful, then the four public yards could, or the two that do aircraft carrier maintenance, could focus less on submarines and more on aircraft carriers. So really, it's kind of redistributing the workload, but it's not easy because there's only 6 yards total that could even contribute to that workload. It's not clear that there's a plan that exists at the moment. I think they're still in talks between industry and the Navy kind of over what that would look like, whether the yards would have to, you know, grow or kind of have annex locations, if it would mean kind of redistributing work between the two private yards and their suppliers. So those are all still talks that are happening now. But definitely to be able to maintain more submarines, you can't do it at the 4 yards that exist today on the public side. You would definitely need some relief elsewhere.
Well, that kind of deals with the supply side of carriers. Let's talk a little bit about the demand side, which is the combatant commanders and their insistence on having carriers at hand. Not, it's understandable, but if we were to reduce the number of carriers, is this going to require some major rethinking on the part of our combatant commanders, or are we going to have to find different ways to get aircraft out there, like putting them on an LHA or whatever?
Dan, do you want to get kicked off on this one, and then I'll follow up?
Yeah, I think so. I think this has been kind of a perennial question in terms of demand for carriers. So on the one hand, you have folks that say, hey, you know, this is obsolete in this era of anti-ship ballistic missiles with a reach of 1,000-plus nautical miles that can wipe you out. But the combatant commanders still want them, and they still want them, and they still want them, and they still want them. And the numbers prove that out. I think in 2018, we took a look at specifically the utilization rates for carriers, and they, you know, going back to the plan before the fleet response plan, the global naval management. It's escaping me at the moment. But you know, the idea is that you had all the carriers on a very tight cycle, on a tight 24-month cycle. You do your 6-month deployment, you turn around, and then you come back, and you know, it was heel to toe on deployments. It doesn't matter if things were getting hot in Kosovo, you had to come home. That change and that paradigm changed at the urging of Donald Rumsfeld and Vern Clark. Most of your listeners probably don't need the history lesson, but the idea that, well, hey, we need to be able to build in more surge capacity because the world gets a vote. As part of the equation on deploying carriers was a big part of that driver. However, when your implementation starts in 2003, right at the start of the Gulf War, and you have seven carrier strike groups deployed, five, you still have a bunch of carrier strike groups deployed at the time in order to service the war in Iraq, plus a couple extra floating around the world, all of a sudden you don't see the combatant commanders turning off the spigot because they have no incentive not to ask for everything in the moon. And it becomes this fight between the Secretary of Defense and the bullets, beans, and Band-Aids people in Washington under the Chief of Naval Operations, and then the combatant commanders go and decide what the best use of forces are. And in that fight, at least since the start of the global war on terror, the CNO, for the most part, loses that fight. And, you know, we've talked to people involved in that process in the tank, you know, at the end of the year when they sit down to do the global force management process. And, you know, the bullets, beans, and the Band-Aids people come up and say, hey, we might not have the forces that you need to meet your requirement. And then all of a sudden, you know, there's a lot of pressure from depending who the combatant commander is or depending on who the Secretary of Defense is in order to meet the obligation downrange, especially in the Middle East. You started to see that change just a little bit. And so if you check out our story on USNI News, under the Mattis administration of the Pentagon, right at the beginning of the start of the new national defense strategy that went into effect in January of 2018, or that's when the unclassed version was populated, you started to see less carriers in the Middle East, and you're starting to see sort of the Earth healing itself, for lack of a better term, and the carrier force starting to get used a little bit less and a little bit more time for maintenance. In parallel, then you had Secretary of the Navy Richard Spencer saying that, like, this is a rebuilding year, this is a readiness year, in order to go and get our aircraft and ships back into fighting shape after getting used and abused for so long. And I want to say it was August of 2019, Secretary Spencer had a roundtable with a bunch of reporters, and I think he'd been at the job for not too long. And he said, it took me pretty much my entire tenure in the Pentagon to realize just how bad the issue is. It's not just that, you know, we have a readiness problem. I did not understand how broad and wide the problem and the issue was. And then during that time, you started to see the combatant commander. I don't know. I would love to have been a fly on the wall in the conversations in the tank, and how, you know, SecDef at the time came down and said, this is the way it's going to be. Because, I mean, the proof is there that you started to see less demand for the carrier force. But that all spiked in May of last year when the tensions with Iran got higher. The Lincoln got deployed pretty much, you know, its entire sort of complex port visits and exercises got all curtailed, and that ship started operating in a very small box in the North Arabian Sea for the rest of its deployment until it turned around and went home. And then the Truman was right behind it. And then that's kind of the way we've been. We've been heel to toe with a carrier in the Middle East pretty much the entire time since May of 2019. So that dynamic has changed in terms of combatant commander demand. And I think you had, when Secretary of Defense Esper was in the seat, I think he was probably more inclined to correspond to the demands of, or to the request, sorry, not demand, to the request of General McKenzie, who's the current central command commander out in the Middle East. So much of that is based on the personality of, you know, the people that are also in the seats there. And none of it, you know, it's very difficult to see, is there a consistent guideline? But the one thing that has sort of remained constant throughout all of this is there is no incentive for a combatant commander to say, oh, I need less of this. I need less of these platforms in my AOR. They're always going to say, I want them, I want them, I want them, I want them. And there's no incentive for them not to.
Yeah, if I could follow that up.
Go ahead, Megan.
Oh, I was just going to say, I've gotten a few questions and, you know, comments on the story. Folks wondering whether the project was meant to say we need more aircraft carriers or less aircraft carriers or whatnot. And I think the point we were really trying to make with this story is that everything regarding carrier usage is a choice, right? So under the National Defense Strategy, Iran is not a top-tier threat. It is a second-tier threat, which isn't to say it's not important. But there's decisions to be made regarding whether to keep an aircraft carrier parked off the coast of Iran versus, you know, doing high-end warfare training, for example, or, you know, catching up on maintenance, building pilot proficiency. Like, these are all choices that need to be made. I'm not the one responsible for making them, thank goodness, because I wouldn't want to be. But, you know, we're looking at two aircraft carriers that are about to do a double pump deployment, one on each coast. And that's the choice that's being made. And so I don't think it's our position to weigh in whether we need more or fewer aircraft carriers. But, you know, when you're looking at Theodore Roosevelt about to go out for a second time this cycle, and you're looking at Dwight D. Eisenhower going out for its own double pump, a lot of it comes down to this current desire to keep an aircraft carrier in the Middle East. And I just think the point we were trying to make was that, you know, as Sam said, of course the combatant commanders are going to ask for aircraft carriers, but the decision to grant that request and keep them there is a choice to have that presence today versus building readiness and building lethality for the future. So that was, you know, I've had a few folks ask, well, why did you even do this project? And I would say, you know, that's one of the reasons, is just really to highlight that this is all a choice. It's not a necessity. It's not, you know, a fact of life. It's something that the Secretary of Defense and the Navy are choosing to do.
Yeah, Megan, what you just said there is so important. If I could put it on a loop, I'd put it on a loop. You said a couple things, but there's a choice here, and there is the future that we have to think about. And I've got a couple questions on stewardship I hope to get to before the end of the show, but I want to go ahead and pull the thread on that because you mentioned the Roosevelt and the two abused children y'all highlighted on your poster here, so to speak, the Truman and the Eisenhower. And you talked about the double pump. And one thing that kept creeping into my mind is a lack of focus on stewardship in the future. And I'll do a couple of quotes here, if I could, because I don't think a lot of people are aware of this outside the maintenance arena. But it's the classic example of what we Southerners call on occasion when the hoss country is shooting up the hoss. And first of all, it talks about the Truman. The Truman is in a, quote, extended carrier increment availability maintenance period, which USNI News understands is a slimmed-down version of a planned incremental availability PIA. The repair period would only tackle selected maintenance items, even though the carrier would be due for a lengthy docking planned incremental availability, DPIA, based on the generic Nimitz-class carrier maintenance plan. Truman is now set to go on its third deployment in 3 years without a full PIA or DPIA, which is without a full partial yard period. For those that were with us in the 1990s, what's going to come to mind is what they did to the Kennedy. And that, one of the classic things, do we ever learn anything? Once people retire, we tend to forget. And then later on in the article, you talk about Truman's ECIA will include work on nuclear power plants, flight deck work, refurbishment of aircraft launch and recovery equipment, and more that creates a, quote, pretty extensive work package. And this is where they put themselves on report. And a little quote from the article, quote, again, he noted that the ship's heavy usage in recent years, particularly its double pump deployment this last cycle, are extending the scope of the work package, unquote. So am I reading this wrong, that we are double pumping carriers that we know will require heavy usage, not just at sea, but when they come in for their availability period, but we're not even giving them full periods. We're giving them partial periods, and we're giving them partial periods. Has there been discussions about what this means, not this POM, but in the late 20s, when this incremental overuse and under maintenance will start to accumulate?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. With Truman, I think the Navy, I don't want to say they brushed it off because that's not quite a fair, accurate characterization. But with Truman, I think it's a little bit easier to say, well, she's next in line for, a midlife refueling and overhaul, the RCOH. So right now, George Washington is in, Stennis is preparing, and then after Stennis goes through RCOH, Truman would be next. I got the impression that they're a little bit more willing to overwork Truman at the moment, just knowing that the RCOH is coming up, within the next decade. Which may be fine for the ship. I'm not an engineer, but I think the crew is also something very important to consider. The crew doesn't care which ship they're on. They're still being overworked. Unfortunately, that's a piece we didn't get as much into in the story just on account of our access to folks. But I think it's worth noting that regardless of when a ship is going to be refueled, they still have people working on them. But the same principle being applied to Eisenhower, for example. Eisenhower has also been similarly overworked on the East Coast. The Navy says she's doing fine to reach her, full 50-year anticipated life. But who knows? They're running the ship really hard. She's the second oldest in the fleet. She's 43 years old. I'm not an engineer, but to me it seems like that's an awful lot of work being done, particularly for a yard where maybe you have a less experienced workforce. Having challenges getting all the proper maintenance done at the yard and then to work her that hard. I can't say with any certainty what the result is. I'm sure some of your listeners are more knowledgeable on the topic than I am. They're being asked to do a lot. They're not receiving their full maintenance requirements in some cases. And then you have the crew to consider as well.
Yeah, I see that we've got a new updated 2020 version of the optimized fleet response plan, which you kindly put into a something you can link to in your article. Can you want to talk about that a little bit? And does this, in your view, does this change anything dramatically, or is this just more planning to plan sort of thing that is going to fall through the cracks if we don't pay attention to what's going on?
That's fine. What stuck out to me about the OFRP update was the emphasis on fleet output compared to an individual ship. So the main pushback I've gotten to this story is that OFRP is not a schedule. It doesn't have to be 36 months. It's okay if not all the ships are perfectly following it. But I think, you know, and I haven't gotten any folks that have agreed to talk to me about this yet. I'm hoping to follow up more in the future. But the OFRP update, as it was written, seems to me that it's an acknowledgement that they can't keep all of the ships in a 36-month cycle at the moment. So to say that, you know, it's a win if we meet all our deployment obligations, regardless of which ship is doing it, that seems to be the direction they're moving in. And again, you know, I think the way that the Navy is achieving that at the moment is by having some crews that are working really, really hard and doing double pumps and staying away from their families and being out at sea where they're not allowed to make port calls because of COVID. And then you have other crews who are stuck in very lengthy maintenance periods, which I can also imagine is not fun. So, you know, rather than try to address that imbalance, it seems like the OFRP update is more focused on saying, well, like, holistically, the fleet is meeting its requirements, so therefore that's a good thing.
Oh, sorry about that. The classic, where is my mute button? Sam, I wanted to bring something up here for you. Is sometimes I wonder where people are viewing things, and it kind of goes to the issue I talked about stewardship before. Is back in the day when I got my MBA, because back in the 1990s, the Navy told me it's important to have it. We did test case studies, and one thing we did is we did studies of businesses whose leadership made sound decisions based upon the wrong criteria. And it usually, some of the classic examples was when you have executive compensation based upon stock sales price, and the better the stock does, the more options they get. So you have leaders in companies who aren't that interested so much in the long-term going concern of the company, but how this quarter or this month they can improve stock price, because that increases their compensation. Same thing about cash flow. There's a great way to generate cash flow if that's what you're being compensated on, by selling off your most valuable assets and keeping your least valuable assets, because you plan to leave the company in 2 or 3 years anyway, so why not maximize my yearly bonus? And there was a quote here that I'm still trying to get my head around, and I believe this was by Vice Admiral Philip Sawyer. And here's the extended quote from the article. Quote, "We look at our schedules and say, okay, What can we do here to make sure the nation is getting the return on investment for that platform, whether it's a cruiser, a submarine, or an aircraft carrier? You could park everything next to the pier and have a lot of war reserve, but that's not a real good return on your investment," unquote. He said when asked about the Theodore Roosevelt and Eisenhower facing double pump deployments, quote again, "So it's a balance between operations, we call peacetime presence, and op tempo for the ship and crew, and we balance that very carefully," unquote. I want to go back to that return on investment for the platform. First of all, it's a complete and utter straw man that to say that anybody is saying that we should just have the entire fleet at parade rest for war. That's not what anybody is asking for. But part of an investment, too, isn't it, making sure that it's an ongoing concern, that the performance this year is no more important than the performance 2 or 3 years from now, especially if you think you have conflict down the road. Where do you see this argument on return of investment coming in? And I'll kind of rephrase the question. Does anybody talk about long-term stewardship, or is it the COCOM ask us to jump? Will somebody send a follow-on message asking how high?
I would love to talk to people about long-term stewardship, and I would love to get into more of those conversations, but that's not typically what we're hearing. I think this goes back again to sort of this notion of return of investment on the carrier force. I think this is very much a 2000s idea, right? Or a late 90s, 2000s idea. You know, I think it's true. It could be an apocryphal story where Donald Rumsfeld calls in CNO and asks them, hey, why are all these carriers not deployed? And they go through the very, you know, sort of the well, we need, you know, we need four carriers to main one carrier underway. This one's training, this one's sustainment. And the way the story goes is Donald Rumsfeld goes, that's really silly. That doesn't make any sense. I have all these assets that I can't use, and they're on the shelf. Let's go and figure out a way how to get these out there, right? And so this is right around the same era of sort of, you know, kind of the businessification of the Pentagon. You have these like Six Sigma, Jack Welch ideas of total efficiency and what was the term of art in the Navy? Total quality leadership, right? The idea that you can bring these business practices of ultimate efficiency into a war fight, and you can really start to squeeze the margins of a military force the same way that you could squeeze the margins of like a flower business or people who make machine parts or, you know, pick an industry. And ultimately, that idea of sort of getting the worth out of the platform does it to me, and from the conversations that I've had with people that have been involved on this, this idea, it has to do with people who look at the carrier force and they see all of this resources and all of this steel sitting around going, well, why can't they be out there all of the time? And without maybe as much of a consideration as to, well, the system was originally designed, the Nimitz were originally designed to have this, you know, one out, three in sustainment balance with a mix of other, conventional carriers. But now we're in this nuclear fleet that 25% essentially utilization for deployment thing is not steady. To the point where it keeps oscillating to like sometimes it's as high as 38 or 40% in a couple of instances, and sometimes it's really low down into like the teens. But there's no consistency, right? And so if I am going to echo what the folks in the Navy, when they go and they argue for their budget, the first thing they tell Congress is we need consistency of funding. We need consistency of funding. And the whole global force management process, which grew from how the Navy allocated resources, was, again, looking at consistency of requirements for deployments. But all of that is very difficult to maintain, that kind of level of readiness, when you're kind of, again, going through these wild oscillations in terms of demand signal from the COCOM. And so you get into these sort of peaks and valleys where you have sort of more carriers at the pier getting worked on because they've gotten overworked, 5, 10 years before. They've done double pump deployment. And that really isn't in anybody's mind. It's only until very, very recently, even in the acquisition process, that Congress has started asking people to like, hey, let's not just talk about the cost of the platform in terms of the money that we need to go and buy right now to get it in the water. We need to talk about sustainment, and those sustainment costs need to be folded into the rest of the conversation. So, I mean, I think it's all, you know, I mean, not to be too rambling here, but this is all part and parcel of the same conversation, which is you're right, no one is really thinking in the long term. And, you know, when you have people, especially on the DC and CONUS side, that are in these positions for like 2, 3, 4 years, there's no institutional memory, or the institutional memory doesn't carry over very well to a long-term view of things, and everyone's coming out at it, you know, in this very short-term way. I think when Megan's story ran last week, I got a couple calls from folks on the Hill saying that, like, we've never had a brief like this in terms of, like, the total use of the carrier force like that. And I don't think the Navy even really thinks about it like that in these big 10, 20-year chunks on how they're getting used. I think, you know, some of the RCOH folks are, but ultimately, you know, the totality of what's getting used and how it's deployed really doesn't enter into anybody's mind, which, to go back to the Sawyer point, you're essentially having to make an argument to folks in the Defense Department who have even less of an understanding, right, in big OSD, who have even less of an understanding of how these have been deployed and overused over the last, you know, 20 years, and then they have to go and come up with some sort of justification to hire to say that, like, oh, yeah, we can go and use this more, or and kind of sort of caught between the reality of the demands from OSD on deploying these forces more and then the reality of the fact that that's what they've been asked to do for the last 20 years. And now, as Megan Story pointed out, you're starting to see some real significant breakdowns where you don't have another carrier. You don't have a surge carrier on the East Coast. Sorry, that was a little long, but I mean, it all of this stuff is connected to each other. And all of these, you know, seeing the ripples of these decisions that were made in the 2000s, coming here to 2020 is just wild.
It's amazing that, you know, you mentioned all the Rumsfeld business plans. They did all the wrong things, at least based upon where I was educated. And, you know, Sam, what you mentioned there is the people who got in touch with you from the Hill who said nobody has briefed us on that. That right there is a bold-faced, underlined indication of where the problem is. Thanks for your patience, Eagle One. Over to you.
Yeah, I was Megan, your article has a pretty good set of quotes from CNO Gilday about this very topic. I mean, he's got to balance his responsibilities, as he points out. He doesn't view it as an 11-carrier problem. He's got a 5-carrier issue. And only down a couple of paragraphs below that, he says that the balance of deploying now versus restoring and preserving readiness comes down to decisions by SecDef. I mean, somebody's got to be, in my view, is anybody screaming to Secretary of Defense saying, hey, look, you know, you can do this today, just like, over, you know, not changing the oil in your car frequently. You can do this today, and you can drive your car really hard, but, you know, 5 years from now, you're not going to have much of a car left. I mean, is anybody shouting this other than USNI and you guys in this particular article?
I don't think so. And I think one of the challenges to that is just the way the budget process works out. I was thinking as Sam was giving his last answer, you know, who's accountable to who and who has what motives. And, you know, if you can't point to your carrier force from last year and say, we did X, Y, and Z, wasn't that really great for the Defense Department? I need more money to continue that next year. It's very hard to make the argument to say, I actually want my carrier force to be used less this year, and I would like more money to keep maintaining them. I think that's a valid argument, but I wouldn't want to be the one pitching that to higher up in the Pentagon or over on the Hill. So I think the way the budget process plays out is, you know, maybe not the most conducive to resetting the aircraft carrier force. And I think there's also maybe, you know, we were talking before return on investment. I think everybody has a little bit of a different idea of what a good return on investment is. You know, for some folks, maybe the Secretary of Defense, maybe others, a good return on investment is having a lot of them out deployed right now. But, you know, when we talk about, you know, the shipbuilding account, there's always this quantity versus quality argument. And actually what I thought was really interesting that the Navy did, you know, we have a chart in the story that shows that in 2018 and 2019, the deployment rates, you know, as a percentage of the overall carrier force were down. But what the Navy did was actually quite interesting. With the Truman, they went on a dynamic force employment deployment. And, you know, it may have just been one ship, but it popped up in some surprise places. You know, it was meant to keep, in this case, Russia on their toes. The carrier went north of the Arctic Circle. They popped in different waters in Europe than they would typically be in. They never went to the Middle East. And so that is a different value than you would get versus having, you know, that permanent aircraft carrier parked off the coast of Iran. So I think right now there's maybe some differences over how to quantify, you know, what the return on investment is and who's looking for what. But I think maybe that might be a recommendation, if I were to be so bold, for the Navy to say, you know, let's change the narrative about what these aircraft carriers ought to be doing and what role they ought to be playing. And maybe it's not how many are deployed right now at any given time, but how are they being used? How are they interacting with adversaries and with allies? And, you know, just maybe turn the narrative just a little bit in that way.
And one other thing that along the same lines, and I believe it was Admiral Meyer in the article, is it goes into the discussion and another straw man that I'm curious what y'all hear on your end, because I haven't read it here. But over Tailhook, Meyer made a comment that I find curious, and Megan, either you or Sam, whichever one may have heard who's making this argument, I'd appreciate it. But the quote from Meyer is, quote, "The budgetary pressure that we're under right now, when we don't get the return on investment, the enormous investment on our aircraft carriers, I describe it as a drop of blood in the water. Every day we lose operational availability further fans the flames of critics who want to cut aircraft carriers," unquote. I have never heard anybody make that argument that we don't need carriers because they have to go in the shipyard to get fixed. Every ship has to get fixed. Every aircraft has to get fixed. Who are these critics that are making this argument? Have either one of y'all heard that? And if so, flesh it out for me, because I find that peculiar.
Yeah, maybe Sam can follow me up. I would say, you know, it's a very prevalent mindset on the acquisition side, which is, you know, if I'm a program manager, I have a cost overrun. Congress is going to penalize me for that next year. So rather than give me the money I need to get the program back on track, I'm almost certainly guaranteed a funding cut going forward. I don't know that that actually exists on the operational side. Maybe it does. Maybe it's just the fear that that mentality would be applied on the carrier side. I mean, I think maybe not all of Congress, but I think at least on the folks centered on sea power, you know, the House Armed Services Committee's Sea Power and Projection Forces Subcommittee is very focused on the shipyards right now. And I think if there were ever a time to really want to address some of these issues and ask for more money to be doing less operationally with the aircraft carriers and be able to have that time to reset them and catch up on maintenance, I think now's the time to do it. There's a lot of folks, you know, not even necessarily from Navy districts, but a lot of folks really seem to be picking up on the finer points of ship maintenance and, you know, supply ships and kind of some typically overlooked issues. So to me, it seems that now would be a good time to try to push that issue. But, you know, as I said, I don't know if it's actually, you know, been a threat of if you don't operate more, your budget's going to be cut, or if it's just the fear that that would be applied, you know, a tactic used in the acquisition programs being applied to the operators.
I think the only follow-up that I would throw on there is, you know, the other unfortunate timing, or fortunate timing for the Navy, you know, we'll go on to see, is what exactly is the plan for aircraft carriers in the future? And this comes as specifically the Ford is taking a long time to get out into the fleet. I got to ride it back in December, and I mean, it's a good-looking aircraft carrier, and I think the Navy will make some pretty good arguments, you know, elevators aside, that they've actually done a pretty solid job in getting things up to snuff. Hopefully we'll get back out there here before too long so we can get another thing. But not having that enter the fleet 2017, and just the relentless criticism on the Ford program specifically, the relentless criticism really kind of fell into sort of a larger narrative about, you know, these exquisite weapon systems that are so expensive to maintain and, you know, are going to be a big, you know, missile sponge in case the balloon goes up, and on and on and on and on. And it all became part of a piece. And I think to Admiral Meyer's point, I don't want to put context that he didn't intend in his remarks at Tailhook, because we still haven't gotten a chance to talk to him. Find Megan. She's a great time for a good 45-minute, hour-long interview. Is that it feeds these critics of the aircraft carrier, right? I was underway with some Marines last year, and it was a really fun conversation about the island hopping campaigns and how you can go and distribute your force and on and on and on. And they were just bagging on the aircraft carrier. The 21st century Maginot Line is the Nimitz class aircraft carrier. It's the Ford class aircraft carrier. It's this thing that isn't nimble and can't move. And it is just sort of one criticism gloms onto another criticism, gloms onto another criticism, and just keeps rolling down the hill until you have sort of this just kind of amorphous blob of anti-carrier sentiment. And when you attach a price tag of $13 billion a hull, all of a sudden it starts, as opposed to, I don't know, Army end strength, all of a sudden it starts to look like a really easy line item that you can just cross out and say, oh, we don't have to worry about this anymore. I have, you know, X amount of studies or, you know, rhetorical strategies in my back pocket that can go and handle this if it comes into sort of a national security discussion or a means to wait, make war discussion. Because that, you know, this capability, rightly or wrongly, has gotten a bad rap. And so when you have availabilities go long and long and long because the force has been overused for 15, 20 years beyond its design criteria, then, yeah, that it makes it a lot easier to kind of just like with a single kind of stroke of a pen, cross it out of a budget line item and move on to the next thing.
Yeah, $13 billion is probably pocket change and fraud in about half our government programs. But that aside, I'm always reminded of the time I asked my dad, who was an Air Force base civil engineer, what the difference was between Navy bases, which always seemed scruffy to me compared to Air Force bases. And his answer was, well, the Navy's got to pay for those ships. I mean, it is a cost of doing business. And a lot of the planning for the maintenance and all this, I guess, and maybe I haven't thought this fully out, but historically, when did we decide we didn't need to continue to improve our shipyards? I mean, this is also part and parcel of your article, Megan, but when at what point did we say, oh, well, we'll go with these four shipyards and we won't bother to improve them until it becomes absolutely desperate? Is that something that we need to consider as part of the when we start talking about the cost of these ships now and the future of maintaining them?
Yeah, I think that, you know, as Sam said, you know, when you start looking at what's easy to cross out of budgets, I'm sure this problem goes much farther back than the last decade. But, you know, I started covering the Navy around the time that sequestration happened. And at that time, you know, anything that wasn't necessary got cut. And I think that kicked off a really bad spiral for the Navy maintenance shipyards. The one, you know, kind of fortunate timing for them at the moment is that there are some upgrades that absolutely have to be made to the yards if they're going to accommodate the Ford-class aircraft carrier and if they're going to accommodate the Block 5 Virginia-class submarines with the Virginia payload module. Some of the dry docks just can't fit the new ships. So the Navy, you know, regardless of budgets, they will have to go through and make some upgrades. They're taking the opportunity to request a lot of upgrades, which I'm sure are well overdue. But, you know, as I said earlier, I think there's some congressmen who maybe aren't looking at the yard upgrades as a side thing, but as, you know, necessary to operations and maintenance. You know, it's not just any installation. It's not, you know, a base that has offices for people to be sitting at desks. It is critical for the Navy's ability to push ships forward and deploy. So I think that mindset might be shifting a little bit right now. Not sure to what extent the Navy's going to be able to take advantage of that. But as I said, I think, you know, the circumstances are kind of in their favor between the new ship classes coming in and just kind of the folks who are in important seats in Congress right now. You know, hopefully the mindset will shift a little bit to, you know, it's not a base, it's a critical tool to be able to deploy.
Megan, just you know, one thing that a lot of people will ask for when you outline, you know, here are these problems, here's what we're seeing. They, you know, accountability, accountability, accountability. And but Sam and you have touched on that a lot of these problems go back to, especially when you look at the problems with the Ford. We had Tal Manville on here a while ago talking about the history of Ford. It definitely goes back to Don Rumsfeld and Vern Clark and the waving away of technology risk and taking a lot of chances on that, which bumps up the price. And the issue with performance of our shipyards, and that too goes for decisions over a decade. There's a lot to blame to go around. And occasionally you'll have people, and you bring it up in your article, well, we've held people accountable. For instance, earlier this year, the Ford program manager was relieved. And then we had the commanding officer at the Norfolk Naval Shipyard was removed back in September due to, quote, poor performance at the yard, unquote. When you look at those particular firings, it's if you want to be cynical, you could go, well, they're just you know, throwing somebody to the wolves. Were there some specific issues that those two individuals deserve to be fired for, or did they just happen to not have a chair when the music stopped? And do you think that they're taking on board a lot of the sins of their predecessors or other people who they weren't even had that job?
I get the impression it might be a little bit of both. For both programs, the rationale that I had been told when the firings both happened was that performance isn't great and we have this other person in mind who we trust and can do better. I think both leaders were put in unfortunate positions where, you know, they weren't left with a program or a shipyard that was in stellar shape at the moment. So I agree with what you said. I think there's such a long history of challenges, both with the Ford program and both at Norfolk Naval Shipyard. Secretary Gertz in particular, being in charge of the acquisition programs, I think he has really striven to not take the status quo and, you know, really try to imagine where the program should be and, you know, what they could be under the right leadership. And so I think, you know, his being in charge may have had a lot to do with it, you know, just wanting better of those programs. So certainly the responsibility doesn't lay on the shoulders of both of those two commanders who, you know, were reprimanded for poor performance. Obviously the poor performance started before they got to those jobs. But I think the Navy's kind of at a point right now of just, you know, we can do better, we should do better. And those were the two that were held responsible.
Yeah, that often happens. Listen, we've wasted about an hour of your time now. And before we let you go, Megan and Sam, have you got some stuff? This is a brilliant article, and I'm glad that the Naval Institute News put it out. It's vital that people read it and understand it. What else you got coming down the pipeline that our listeners can look forward to? And Megan, why don't you start?
Oh, goodness. I think we're really trying to, in the similar vein, try to figure out the people side of this. As I mentioned earlier, you know, ships, obviously we want to keep them in good shape, but they can be reset, they can be overhauled. And the people aspect of this is just really unfortunate. You know, COVID has obviously put more strain on everybody in the Navy, outside of the Navy, but I just think kind of looking at mental health issues and personnel issues and kind of how they're being worked, how they're being supported is something we definitely want to keep an eye on, as well as, you know, just COVID overall as it relates to ship construction and ship maintenance. Everything that I outlined in my piece is kind of best case scenario in terms of, you know, when the East Coast will have more deployable ships. I think we're going to see, hopefully it's not as bad as I'm worrying, but I think this is going to be a long winter in terms of the shipyard's ability to keep up with the workload and keep enough workers there to make good progress. So that is certainly something I'll have my eye on, is how this virus affects the ability for the Navy to keep its fleet ready.
Sam, what you got?
Well, we've got, in the short term, I think we've been looking at some allied navies I had a really good conversation with essentially the Australian equivalent of they've rolled their NAVC and NAV Air person into one rear admiral, and we had a nice chat last week. So hopefully in the not too distant future, we'll have a look. They're doing some real smart things with unmanned and in terms of strategy and thinking about that. In the longer term, I think what Megan's piece did, and I think for a lot of people in D.C. especially, really put context into the aircraft carrier debate. Sal, like you said earlier, aircraft carrier debate, actually, one of the first things we did at USNI News back in 2013, 2014, we took all of the proceedings articles, also a Flying Naval Institute publication. If any listeners aren't members, come on, join up, usni.org, is the every single carrier debate going back to the 20s. And there were like 15 stories, 15 takes and proceedings about how the carrier is not long for this world, going back to like, you know, 36, 37. And it's a wild history that I think not a lot of people understand. But I think with the numbers that Megan brought up, it really starts to pose some real legitimate questions. It's like, well, if these things are so useless, why does everybody want one? I'm not saying they are. I'm not saying that are they aren't. That's not a role in society. But, like, it's a really good opportunity to go and inform whatever the next fleet architecture is. It's because the Navy right now, on the air side, on the sub side, on the surface side, and on the carrier side, is at an inflection point about what it wants to look like. And with the uncrewed side, is at an inflection point on what it wants to be going forward. And we're going to be paying really close attention into how the Navy is going to be able to go with a new change in leadership in the Pentagon right now. Secretary Esper had a vision that might not have been the Navy's original vision. And there's still a lack of clarity as to what the path forward is for the service. And I think looking at the carrier piece of this, especially considering it's the one with the hardest momentum to change, is what we're going to be spending a lot of time thinking about between now and probably March or April.
Well, that should keep everybody reading up. And Megan and Sam, really appreciate you all taking time today to join us. And for those that are on Twitter, of course, if you are not already, go ahead and subscribe to at USNI News. And you can find Megan at Mayday, MAEDAY22. And Sam has got a real cryptic Twitter handle, at Sam Lagrone. So we look forward to the next conversation, and I hope that you and yours have a great holiday season that we have coming up.
Thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot, guys. Appreciate it.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Mid-Regrets. And until next time, hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Molly wrote a neat reply to Irish Paddy O, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame for love of Shirley.